Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Welcome. Good morning. I'm sorry I missed you last week. I was suffering, I think, from the flu, which I had taken a shot for and got sick from the shot. But that was 2 months ago. So I think it was, I can't say it was the flu exactly. It could have been a virus, but I had 103.5 for a couple of nights, and I was, you would not have wanted me to be here. All right. Anyway, we're moving now into Parshat Toldot. We're moving from Parshiot Lech Lecha and Vayera and Chayei Sarah, which dealt with the lives of Avraham and Sarah. And we're moving now to Parshas Toldos with Yitzchak as the bridge to the next generation. Now, we've spoken about Yitzchak before, and I just want to review a couple of things about him before we move to what's going to be the major focus of our class today, which is the struggle between Yaakov and Esav. Yitzchak is the most enigmatic of all the avos and imos. In other words, his story is the most difficult to unravel in terms of its message, in terms of what it's trying to teach us, etc. Avraham's story is clear. You see the various things that he does. Yaakov's story is somewhat clear as well in terms of the struggles that he has, but Yitzchak's a quieter story. You don't really see a great deal happening in his life. And one of the things that I've tried to underscore in my life, in my speaking with you, is that Yitzchak actually is an extremely important figure in Jewish history, because he is the first one to face the challenge which we call Mesorah. He's the first one to face the challenge of not only receiving a heritage from God, but receiving a heritage from a prior generation. To say he's the first Jewish child is not accurate, because there are no Jews yet, but to say that he is the first progenitor, the first child born into what will become the Jewish nation, is accurate. And as such, what you see happening with Yitzchak, and I think you have to read the text very, very carefully, is that Yitzchak struggles with what I believe is the major challenge of Mesorah. What we often define Mesorah tradition as, I receive from one generation and I hand it down to the next. That's not an accurate translation. It's missing what I think is the most important part. You receive from one generation, you make it your own, and then you hand it down to the next. And as Judaism courses through you, and as it courses through your generation and your time, it shifts, it changes, it receives from the ambience around us. As I said to you a few weeks ago, gefilte fish isn't in the Torah. Right? Chalent is not something that was commanded at Sinai. These are all aspects, and yet to say that gefilte fish is Jewish, unless you're Sephardi, you might argue it, but the fact is that these are elements of tradition which become infused and woven into our world. We accept them as Jewish, and they are contributions of the times and the peoples through which Torah courses. And therefore, as the Torah courses through Yitzchak and Rivka, it's changing. It's being added to by the personalities of the individuals. And if you look carefully at the story of Yitzchak as it unfolds in the beginning half of Parshas Toldos, because part of the problem also is that as soon as you get to Yitzchak, it's almost overwhelmed by the story of Yaakov and Esav, which is so much more dramatic. But if you look at Yitzchak alone, what you find is that he is struggling. He is struggling to accept his father's and mother's tradition and struggling somehow to make it his own. He stays in the land of Israel. He never leaves once. There's a point where he's about to leave and a Kodesh Baruch Hu tells him to stay. And yet he's always uncomfortable. There is no point in the Torah where the Torah says, Vayeshev Yitzchak. It says, Vayogor Yitzchak. And even God commands him, Gur ba'aretz hazos, dwell in this land. This is your fate. Your fate is not to be totally, as much as your life may be less dramatic than the others, your life on a personal level, you're going to be struggling. You're not going to ever be 100% comfortable in this land. And it's a sad aspect of Yitzchak's legacy. One wonders, and we'll see this in a few moments, how much the Akedah had an effect on Yitzchak. And we'll see that when we get into this, the discussion of Yaakov and Esav. How much the Akedah may have had an effect on him, and we'll see hints of that within the Medrash. But then we also see Yitzchak emerging. Even though he digs the same wells as his father, and even though he calls them the same names, he digs his own wells as well. You'll remember, I showed you how Avraham fell into a trap, according to Chazal, when it came to the covenant with Avimelech. A generation later, Yitzchak does not fall into that same trap, and he learns from his father's mistakes. But you have to read the text carefully, because it almost looks like a mirror image event, and it's not. It's clear. There's no bris when it comes to Yitzchak. Yitzchak has his eyes wide open when it comes to Avimelech, as opposed to Avram, who seemed to be willing to accept certain things without the safeguards that were necessary. So therefore, before we move to Yaakov and Esav, let's pay tribute to Yitzchak and Rivka. Let's recognize the particular roles they play. We've spoken about some of the details. There's more to talk about, but we're going to move now to the next generation. But we're doing so without leaving Yitzchak and Rivka behind, because their role in the struggle between Yaakov and Esav is extremely important. Let's take a look. And I've divided the story that we're going to be looking at today into the cause, the plan, a possibility, etc. Let's look first at the cause. What is this enmity that exists between Yaakov and Esav? Where does it stem from, and what is its, and what exacerbates it? Well, first of all, before we even begin, HaKadosh Baruch Hu predicts it to Rivka right from the start. Before she gives birth, the Torah says in the beginning of Parshas Toldos that Rivka is struggling. She doesn't understand what's happening. I am the father of twins. You can speak to my wife. She can tell you it's different. In fact, the only thing was that I was a rabbi in Englewood, and the rabbi in Teaneck, after we had twins, his wife had triplets. So my wife said she's bowing out of the competition. But anyway, the fact is that Rivka's trying to understand what is this pregnancy, what's happening to her, et cetera, et cetera. She goes to Bidoresh Hashem, and she receives a very, very significant message. She says, the message she receives are, there are two nations in your womb, and they are going to struggle. Ula'om mil'om ye'ematz. And one nation will always be stronger than the other. And the rabbis understand this in a very, very particular way. And we'll see it later on when we get to the struggle between Yaakov and the angel. There can be no peace between, on a philosophical level, between a Yaakov and an Esav, is what we are being told in that phrase, ul'om mil'om ye'amatz. And Chazal actually say it clearly. On that phrase, they say the following statement, a very famous statement. If someone says to you that Yerushalayim and Caesarea are both standing, don't believe him. If someone says to you that Yerushalayim and Caesarea are both destroyed, don't believe him. If someone says to you, Yerushalayim stands and Caesarea is destroyed, you can believe that. And God forbid, if someone says to you, Caesarea is standing and Jerusalem is destroyed, you can believe that. Which is Chazal's way of saying, these two symbols cannot coexist. Now the rabbis, and it's not genealogical, at least according to the historians, but the rabbis will say, who does Esav eventually represent in rabbinic literature? Does anyone know? Edom. Rome. And that's what they're saying. What they're saying is that Rome's philosophy and Israel's philosophy cannot coexist. And it wasn't until, and I was there again recently, you stand outside the Colosseum, and you think of what was entertainment to the Romans. And you put yourself in the rabbinic position, and you say, if that's entertainment, then we can't stand together. These are two different worlds in terms of the way you view human life, two different worlds in terms of the way you view sanctity, two different worlds. So the struggle between Yaakov and Esav on some level is predetermined, which raises its own questions about free will. But we'll just say that it's predetermined in broad brush strokes, and then we fill in the details with our own free will. But then that struggle, this division between these two... Yes, I'm sorry. It's a very interesting question. It you know, one of the things we're going to see in this whole story is it's not clear what she shares with him and what she doesn't. I don't know. You don't know. And if not, why not? And what does that mean about the family dynamic? There's much to talk about. But you see, we have to be very careful. We can only talk about those things where the Torah gives us hints, right? And the hint here is that there is not a great deal of communication, all right? Which then raises its questions and without any clear answers. What happens, though, of course, is that this natural division between these two children who begin growing up very differently and apparently from the womb. And by the way, as a parent of five and grandparent of many, thank God, I the whole nature-nurture argument we used to have in school, I firmly believe that 90% of it is nature and the rest of it is nurture. In other words, that who they are is who they're born. I mean, I can point to the qualities of my children from the moment they're born. How they then use those qualities and how we help them develop those qualities and how we direct them becomes an issue. But so much of who the person is. So here we see Yaakov and Esav are immediately moving in different directions. Vayehav Yitzchok es Esav. Kitzayid b'fiv, v'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. And Yitzchak loved Esav because what's tzayid b'fiv, literally, we'll take the pashat pshat for now, which means he provided for him, he gave him game. The rabbis would say tzayid b'fiv means he lied to him, he hunted. That's medrashic. Let's take the pashat pshat. He provided for him. And Rivka ohevet es Yaakov. Rivka loves Yaakov. What strikes you about that pasuk? Is there a difference between these two loves? Okay. Number one, very, very clearly, Yaakov's love for Esav is what we would call Yitzchak's, I'm going to mix them up a lot today. Yitzchak's love for Esav is what we call in Hebrew tluya badavar. Tluya badavar means it's a love that is dependent. The rabbis will say there are two kinds of love. There is ava hatluya badavar and ava sheina tluya badavar. Independent love. Love that doesn't matter what you're receiving, you love that person. And the rabbis will say ava hatluya badavar sofo shelo lehiskayim. Eventually, dependent love will not last. It's love that is independent of conditions that eventually will persevere. But there's something else. Do you notice the tent? What else do you notice here? As opposed to? Excellent. Right. The Torah is telling us something there, right? Isn't that powerful? Vayehav means he loved him. Rivka oheves, Rivka loves Yaakov. There's a fundamental difference between that tone. One is, you know, it's limited. But Rivka, it's an overwhelming love. It's a love that now, obviously, this creates its own problems, one would argue, right? The rabbis will say, when they comment on the Yaakov story with Yosef, that you should never openly show favoritism to a child, because look how it ends up. So it's important for us to understand that this... Now, why can we understand? And here again, we're being careful because we're we're proposing possibilities that have hints in the text but are not outright. Why might Yitzchak gravitate to an Esav?
Rivka could see Yaakov's nimbus.
Right.
But Yitzchak couldn't see at all.
Okay. So what is okay, so see it all physically or spiritually or philosophically? What do we mean here? So you're raising a good point. We're told that Yitzchak is blind, right? Now, what does that, is that a physical blindness? On one level, clearly it is. But is there another kind of blindness that is at play here? What do we know about a parent who may feel somewhat weak or may have felt they will gravitate to what? To strength, right? In other words, is it possible that, and here's the hint, right? But the two things, it says, Yitzchak gets old and he can't see well. So look at the rabbinic, and here we'll quote a medrash. The Medrash says, "B'sha'a she'okad Avram Avinu espino al gabei ha-mizbeach." When Yitzchak was placed on the Mizbeach and bound on the Mizbeach by his father, "Bachu malachei ha-shares," the angels began to cry. Skip to the end. "V'nishru d'ma'ot me'enehem l'tocheinav." Vahayu rishumot betochenav vekevan shehizikon koenav. And the tears from the angels dripped into the eyes of Yitzchak and affected his eyes and caused blindness. Now, it's a powerful imagery, but perhaps are the rabbis saying that on some level that seminal event had an effect on Yitzchak? The rabbis will say Yitzchak's the first survivor in Jewish history. Right? Now I will tell you something that I remember. I'm an American born child to American born parents. And that made me different from so many of my contemporaries. So I couldn't understand a great deal of what people were going through in survivor families. But I remember when I was a rabbi in Potomac, so they were having one of the very first survivors conferences was taking place in Washington. And I went as a rabbi. And I remember being in JFK Stadium, or whatever stadium it's called, and Ronald Reagan was the president. And every time someone mentioned the word Israel, or the state of Israel, spontaneously the entire assemblage stood up and started cheering. And you got this sense that this was something they need. This is what the survivors needed. The survivors needed that strength. The survivors needed to imagine. I can look at an IDF soldier, but when a survivor looks at an IDF soldier, it's a whole different ball game. And therefore, is it possible, and we're just throwing this out, that part of the mechanism that's happening here with Yitzchak is he's gravitating to strength. He's gravitating to the here and now. That may be why God won't let him leave the land of Israel, because you can't expect the survivor to live on a promise of coming back. Maybe these are aspects, and I'm throwing it out there. You can argue it. You don't have to accept it. These are theories, because the Torah doesn't say it outright. But there's something here, I think, where it talks about that father gravitating to the strength of an Esav and looking at that warrior and saying, that's my son, which is an amazing thing. Now, having said that, clearly this creates its own dynamic and its own problems, and who knows what's going on in this family between Esav and Yaakov. We know the struggle for the Bechora. We know that Esav comes back one day and says, who cares about the Bechora? Give me the lentil soup, and buys the Bechora. But then we get to what is really the crux of the story. And that's towards the end of Parshas Toldos, when Yaakov, at the direction of his mother, seems to steal Esav's bracha. So now we need to look at this story as if, and we've said this over and again, as if we've never seen it before. Let's try to raise the questions that are valid, real questions about it, as if we're seeing it with new eyes, and let's see if we can answer some of them. Rivka Amra El Yaakov. Yes, I'm sorry. Well, that's true, but it seems to be very important to him, right? In other words, it seems. All right, but it doesn't say anything about his relationship with Yaakov. It seems to be very specific that when the Torah says Yitzchak loves Esav because, and Rivka loved, right? So it's giving you a. It doesn't say he loved him, but he loved him too. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right, correct. No, there's, look, the rabbis will say that Esav perfected a particular mitzvah, and that was the mitzvah of Kibud Av. All right, so you're making an excellent point. This was something that Yitzchak saw in this son and nurtured it and provided for it. But let's go on now. Okay, so, excellent. Rivka Amra El Yaakov. Beno, lemor. Hine shamati esavicha medaber el esav achicha lemor. Rivka turns to Yaakov and says, I've heard your father speaking to Esav. Havia li tzayid, bring me, and by the way, this underscores, what does Yitzchak say to Esav? He says, go bring me food so I can bless you. So this conditional nature of this bracha is underscored. So I've heard that go bring me beautiful food, etc., etc. V'yatobani, and now my son Rivka says to Yaakov, V'yatobani shma b'koli la'asher ani mitzaveh oscha. And now my son, listen to my words, the words that I am, what? Commanding you. Go get to Gedizim, take some goats, Tovim. I'm going to make the food that your father loves. You'll bring them to your father. I want him to bless you before he dies. Now let's stop. What questions emerge in your mind when you look at this directive and you look at the beginning of this story here? What questions? Make believe you've never seen it before.
Why did Rivka have to say to Yaakov, I command you?
Good. Good question. Okay. I command you. Keep going. We'll answer that. We'll answer it.
Why couldn't she just say,
I'm asking you. All right. Yes.
Because she received Ruach HaKodesh from God.
I hear, okay, but nonetheless, his question is a valid question. Wouldn't Yaakov have listened to her if she didn't command him? Why?
She received Ruach HaKodesh and she's transferring the Ruach HaKodesh.
Okay, good, okay. Let's hold on to that answer because it will be one of the currents we're going to be looking at. Let's keep going. What else? Yes.
As a mother, Yaakov would do this.
Right, okay, and right. So there, okay, good, excellent. Let's keep going. What other questions emerge? I don't want answers yet. What other questions emerge? Yes. Good, right. What is the relationship between the eating and the bracha? We already, right, keep going. Any other questions? Excellent question. Do the ends justify the means? All right, that's a very valid question. What does the Torah want us to learn from this event? Does the Torah want us to learn that at times, whatever you do, there is a goal, and whatever the cost may be, and whatever the morality may be, you follow that road? We'll get there. Yes.
A bracha
Excellent question. See, to me, and it's rare that people raise it. I've asked this question over and over again. I consider that to be the most difficult question here, which is, I'll repeat it, a blessing given in deception, what's its value? In other words, what do we believe about this concept of bracha? We're turning it into magic as opposed to religion. It's one thing if you say, and we need to discuss this, I can give a bracha to my son. I've got 5 children. I go to Avi and I say, Avi, this is the bracha I want to give to you. But let's say I'm saying a bracha and for some reason it's the middle of the night. I think I'm talking to Yossi, right? And I give Yossi the bracha that I intend to give to Avi. What does that mean? Does it hold? Does God say, okay, just because you said those words on Yossi, now that's the bracha Yossi's going to get as opposed to the bracha that Avi's going to get? So the answer is, that to me is perhaps the most perplexing of all questions here, which is what's the nature of a bracha and what's its power? And is its power so independent that if words are spoken in error, they still have a strength? Because she knows that he's going to be giving this bracha if the plan goes through, he's going to give him the bracha and it's going to be a mistake. It wasn't meant for Yaakov. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. No, she. All right. So I didn't put in the rest of the text. Good criticism. She basically says to him, "Dress up like Esau." She basically says to him, "Go take the skin of the goats and put it on your arms. Go, I want you to present yourself as Esau." That's part of this paragraph. It's, in other words, okay. I forget your name.
Reuben.
I'm going to say the following. That's that answer, accepted, taken. It's not the only answer to what we're dealing with. So what I'm suggesting is the following. It's one way of understanding the text. One way of understanding the text, and we'll see. I'll show you. One way of understanding the text is that this is all prophetic vision, and she's doing everything she's doing is prophetic, and the questions we're raising are immaterial. That's good. Okay, we could end the class there, but we're not. So therefore, what I'm saying to you is the following, that's one way of approaching Chumash text. Another is, wait a minute, what do you mean it's immaterial? Couldn't she have done this a different way? Couldn't she have done it without deceiving him? What does deceit, is this, does the Torah want us to learn that deceit is an appropriate way of doing things? These are valid questions. Even if I accept that everything she's doing is being dictated by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nowhere does it say that. It's him saying to her, do it this way. And we have distinguished between Medrash and Pshat. We're looking at Pshat. Okay? So there's no need to bring it up. I accept that as an approach and say that if that were the approach, we wouldn't need to continue the discussion. But now we're continuing the discussion. All right? Good. Yes. Yeah. All right. So, you're getting to the morality of it, and we'll come back to it. So let's just stop for a minute because we're going to run out of time, and I don't want to do that. This is excellent questioning. There are serious questions here. Unless we take the approach that everything God is saying the questions are: what's the morality of her instructions? Couldn't she have done it another way? What is the benefit of a bracha received in error, when you think you're giving it to one person and what's this all about? So let's start with what I consider to be the most difficult question, which is a question of bracha. This really raises a much deeper question, which is, what is the nature of an interpersonal blessing in Jewish thought? Let's take a Misha Beirach for a chole. God, there's someone who's sick. I believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to do what is appropriate and right for that individual. I also believe that that should be based upon God's relationship with that individual and what that individual deserves and what that individual's fate, etc., etc., etc. All of a sudden, here I come and I say, Kodesh Baruch Hu, I'm making a bracha for him. Wait a minute, why should my blessing make a difference? Right? Why should my bracha make a difference? Shouldn't that person's fate be determined by that person's fate and that person's merits and that person's demerits? What is the nature of a human bracha? So what we have to say, and here we go back now to Avraham, one of the very first things God says to Avraham is, Veheye bracha. You will be as a blessing. And the rabbis right on the spot say, Habrachot mesurot lecha. Blessings, I am handing over the power of blessing to you. Which means that what we believe about brachot is the following. That Hashem is consciously withdrawing to give us space. To give us space to determine our fate and the fates of others through our words and through our tefillot. I mean, it's really not just a question of bracha, it's a question of tefillah too, isn't it? If I deserve to have X, Y, or Z, why should I? Because tefillah changes me. Tefillah changes the dynamic. Tefillah changes who you are. There are whole sorts of answers here. So therefore, what we believe is there is a power to a blessing. There's a power to a blessing. And a blessing that is recited with a full heart, HaKadosh Baruch was saying, I will factor that into the equation. Even if we're talking about a third party, I'll factor it into their equation as well. Your blessing's going to have, and that couldn't exist without Hashem's allowance. Let's really understand that. That's Hashem saying, I'm giving you this power. It's not self-understood that that power should exist. There are those who will take this a step further as an answer to your question. There are those who will say that the words of a tzaddik have a roshem. That if I'm going to take this concept of bracha to its extreme, then if a tzaddik says something to X, even thinking it's Y, God can't ignore those words. Somehow that has now entered into the equation. And therefore, yes, even a bracha given in deceit has some power beyond our... Now, there are others who argue that. There are others who will say, maybe the power is the power it has on the person's psyche. Maybe it's, you know, if Yaakov sees that blessing being said to Esav, maybe that will affect Yaakov a certain way, as opposed to if Yaakov sees the blessing coming to him, even if it comes through deceit. So these are other elements. But the question, in some ways, the question is better than the answer, and it is an extremely difficult question. Yes.
Words have power.
And words spoke. And that's part of the lesson here. That words have power. Whatever you say to someone about someone has an effect. Right, which is right, correct. With Hashem's original plan, which brings us back to correct. So this all intertwines. Now we're putting aside the morality now for a moment. We're going to put aside the morality. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it today, if not next week. Let's, however, approach this whole story now a little bit differently. And we'll see that there's a possibility here that a lot of people don't recognize, that many, some within Chazal did recognize, and it changes the dynamic more than we think. take a look for a moment at the bracha that this is all about, right? We're all struggling. Yaakov and Esav are struggling to receive the bracha that Yitzchak intends to give to who? To Esav. Let's read it. Bottom of the page. Vayigash vayishaklo. So, where are we now? Yaakov's done what his mother commanded him. He has successfully, it would seem, deceived his father. He's standing before Yitzchak now, and Yitzchak is now about to give this bracha to Yaakov, thinking that he is Esav. Vayigash vayishaklo. Yaakov comes near. He smells the aroma of the field. He smells the aroma of the garments. And apparently this is the beginning of the bracha. Behold, the aroma of my son is like the aroma of the field that has been blessed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'yiten lecha ha'elokim. And here's the famous part that we've all seen before. May God give you mital hashamayim u'mishmanei haretz. May he give to you from the dews of the heaven and from the fatness, the wealth, the richness of the earth. Virov dagon v'sirosh. And may he give you much plenty, much crop. Ya'avducha amim v'yishtachavu l'chol u'mim. Nations will work for you and will bow down to you. Havei gevir li'achecho, v'yishtachavu l'cho b'nei imecho. You will be a leader for over your brother, a gevir, a ruler over your brothers, and the children of your mother will bow down to you. Orarecho arur, u'mekalelcho, u'mevarechecho baruch. Those who curse you will be cursed, and those who bless you will be blessed. What's missing in that bracha? Not the land, what else? Spirituality. Let's take a look at this bracha. Right? What is this blessing? Totally material in nature. And one backs up and says, this is what it's all about? This is what we're fighting for? This is what Rivka is fighting for Yaakov? And this is the bracha of a patriarch? Right, what would I expect from a patriarch? The land of Israel, I would expect the heritage of my father, I would expect God's blessings, a spirituality. This is all material. Now, and here's the kunz, and this is what nobody pays attention to. At the end of the story, there's a second blessing. There's a blessing that he gives to Yaakov when he knows he's talking to Yaakov. What's the scene? The scene is that Esav comes back and he says, "Is it pot? You know, don't you have another blessing?" And God, and Yitzchak blesses him too. But and Yitzchak is all in an uproar. And Rivka turns to Yaakov and says, "I'm going to lose both of you guys, right? Now I've lost Esav because he's going to hate me. But now also, he's going to kill you. So I want you to run to the house of Laban, my brother. I want you to find a wife for yourself, and I want you to protect yourself from your brother." She tells Yitzchak. Here she tells Yitzchak. She speaks to Yitzchak, and she says to Yitzchak, "Katzti b'chayai, I can't do this. I want Yaakov to go back and get a wife for himself." And Yitzchak calls in Yaakov. And look at what he says. Vayikra Yitzchak el Yaakov. We're now on the second page, second paragraph. Yitzchak calls Yaakov, Vayivarech oso. See the underlined words? He blesses him. Of his own volition, right? He doesn't have to be tricked to do it. Vayomer lo, lo tikach isha bimnos Kanan. Do not take a wife from the children, from the daughters of Canaan. Kum lech padenu aram, etc. Go to the house of Besuel, your mother's father, etc. Pasuk gimel. Ve'el Shaddai Yevarechoscha. Now, right off the bat, it's not Elohim anymore. Let's understand, there are different ways to refer to God. Elohim is generic. Paro calls God Elohim. Right? Elohim means God. Kel Shakai is specific, like Hashem. V'yafrecha v'yirbecha v'yisa l'kalamim. And he will bless you and make you plenty, and you will be the progenitor of nations. V'yiten l'cha es birkas Avraham. Wow. U'lezaracha yitcha. L'rishtecha es eretz migurecha asher nasan Elohim li'Avraham. What do we see? What we saw missing in that first bracha is present here. Which leads some within Chazal to say we understand the story all wrong. There wasn't one blessing. There were two blessings. And Yitzchak, although he may have preferred and loved Esav, he related to Yaakov as well and understood his sons. And he was a very good father. And as a very good father, what did he decide to do? What you or I would normally do, which is turn to the children and say, okay, what is this child's talents? What are the things that this child needs to be blessed with? And this child needs to be blessed with Esav. Wow, what does he need to be blessed with? He needs to be blessed with superiority and strength and the fatness of the land. And what is Yaakov? Well, Yaakov sits and learns. Right? Yaakov's sitting in the tent. So what does Yaakov need? Yaakov needs the spirituality. Yaakov needs the legacy of Avram. You don't see the legacy of Avram being given to Esav by Yitzchak. You see it being given to Yaakov. Along comes Rivka. So what does he say? So what is Yitzchak's cheshbon? Yitzchak's cheshbon is, I'm going to bless each child with a blessing appropriate for that child. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say, partner, guys. You know, you learn and he'll support you. Sound familiar? All right? But you know, you learn and he'll support you. Yeah, I'm making Esav the Gvir Liachecha. I'm saying, Esav, you will be the Lord over your brother. I mean, you're responsible for your brother. And Yaakov will be free to pursue the dreams of esoteric learning in the mists of... Along comes Rivka. And Rivka says, no. No. Two things. You don't make a partnership between Esav and Yaakov. You don't make Yaakov dependent on Esav. Can you imagine if that's what would have happened? But secondly, and this is what I believe, and this is part of my addition to this whole thing, she believes that in order to survive, you need both. That in order for Yaakov to survive as an individual, and in order for Yaakov to survive as the progenitor of Klal Yisrael, you can't just sit in the tent. You got to get out there, and you have to fight. You have to fight for what's yours, and you have to struggle on the stage of life. And she says, Yaakov needs both brachot. And what does she do? She takes this Kolel boy, and she shoves him out into the world. Right? Isn't that what she's doing? She's saying to him, it's not just go get the bracha, it's go, you go get the bracha. I'm not going to fight this battle. You've got to get out there. You've got it on the stage. You've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to do what you need to do to get what's yours. And Yaakov, from that moment on, by the way, is able to do that. Right? He ends up going to the house of Lavan and staying for a long time. But beyond that, surviving and succeeding in a world which is duplicitous and trying, and he's the one who manages it and survives and succeeds. That's all part of it. That's all part of it. But she recognizes again that in order for the Jewish people to succeed, both brachot have to be present. That you can't just, now, I'm not going to get political, I'm not going to get Haredi, non-Haredi, this, that, you know, there's a whole piece where you can take this whole discussion to, which is, and Israeli society is coming to terms with it, and you see more and more Haredi people within the Haredi community coming out and saying, we have to become self-sufficient, we have to become supportive, we cannot, because you can't have that equation forever, and I'm not comparing it to Yaakov and Esav. But I'm saying this need to be able to succeed, we wouldn't be here today had we not had the talent to survive in the world.
Does that mean that if Yitzchak had gone ahead and given Esau a rock that was appropriate to his needs, to his direction, to his wants, to his striving, etc., that he couldn't then go ahead and give Yaakov a rock that was consistent with his striving?
So, excellent, excellent question. And that was his plan. But I believe what Rivka sees is that psychologically and emotionally, Yaakov needs to understand that he has to have both of these blessings. And it wasn't going to happen. In other words, for whatever reason, and this brings us back to a question that was raised earlier about the communication within the family, which I can't fully answer. Because this whole thing could have been avoided, right? Had Rivka sat down with Yitzchak and said, Yitzchak, I understand that you're planning to give them two brachot, but you know what? He needs this bracha too, but apparently that couldn't happen for whatever reason. And Yitzchak was set in what he was intending to do. And Rivka needed Yaakov to get out there and recognize his need for both of those blessings. It wasn't just that he had to get them, he had to see the need for them, because Yaakov perhaps would have been very, very content to stay in the tent. He needed to see it. Yes. Both of you. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Correct. Correct. In order to... That's piece A. That's piece A. I believe there are two pieces. I think piece A is what you said and what we said, which is it couldn't be a partnership between them. And I think piece B is Yaakov has to know that he needs both. Yes?
I think there's a contradiction, and I never thought of it as a monetary game, but Yaakov could have given the exact same benefit to Esau because you'll earn a living and
right.
Was
he almost does.
The second was going to be impossible.
Right. The only difference is that when he gives it to Esav, and he gives Esav a blessing, he doesn't put in and won't put in the part Havei Gevir Li'Achecha, which is what she was saying. In other words, that full bracha can't go to Esav. Because if that full bracha goes to Esav, then he then becomes the controller of Yaakov's destiny as well. Yes, the physical aspect could go, and Esav receives a physical blessing. But the blessing of superiority, of control, that can't go. Yes? Right. That's one way of looking, correct. That's one way of looking at Elohim versus Kel Shakai and Hashem. Another way of looking at it is Elohim is a generic phrase. Elohim means it could mean the God of Moab, it could mean the God of, when we use it within our context, yeah, there's a test going on, I think. So I heard there was going to be a test around this time. All right, so anyway, yes, but Elohim also means, you have it with Yosef. Yosef says, Elohim Yaneh Shlom Paro, and then Paro says, is there Ruach Elohim in anybody like this? There's no Hashem there, it's Elohim, it's God, in a generic sense. There could be 10 gods. In this case, it meant Hashem, but it's in a generic way, or it's in a as you say, maybe he's saying, if you deserve it, you'll get it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, a way of looking at a very familiar story in a very new way. Let's discuss it. Let's think about it. Next week, we have to talk about the morality. We didn't get a chance to speak about that. In other words, do the ends justify the means? Is that what the Torah wants us to learn? Et cetera, et cetera. Okay, thank you very, very much, everybody. All right, if you don't mind finding that fellow, David. Oh, you did, okay. You'll talk to him. Okay, great. Super. Thanks very much.